Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Simone Drake, who is one of the two editors of Are You Entertained? Black Popular Culture in the 21st Century. Simone edited this with Dewan Henderson, and it is a really fascinating interrogation and exploration of Black popular culture, its meaning, and a lot of the various dimensions to it as we think about and try to understand the role of popular culture, particularly Black popular culture in the United States. But I'm going to let Simone talk to us a little bit about that. I'd like to welcome Simone to the New Books podcast and ask her to tell us a little bit about herself and how she came to this really interesting project. Hi, Simone.
Hello, Lily. Thank you for inviting me to talk about Are You Entertained? So this project kind of, I guess, was a long time in the making, both as far as producing it, but also just in my thinking about it. My first year in my graduate program in African-American studies, I took a course on Black feminist theory, and Michelle Wallace's and Gina Dent's Black Popular Culture was on the reading list. It had just come out either that year or a few years before. And it was, as a classics and English major, it was really my first introduction to an actual academic course that engaged with Black popular culture. And I was really quite fascinated by it. And you know, that kind of stuck with me. But fast forward many years later, I started working in the area of Black popular culture, but also in teaching it. And some things that I kind of picked up on was that it was really hit or miss whether it was approached as a field of study or something you could just pick up and do, right? Because it was something that you liked or you enjoyed. And so at first I thought about doing a journal on Black popular culture because I was on a board for another journal with Indiana University Press, and the serial editor there had talked to me about it. And I talked to one of my mentors and she said, why don't you just do an edited volume? Because it's expensive to be able to get a journal started up. And did I really want to have to do that work year after year? So I decided to do the book and then I found out that it actually took years and years to get an edited volume really organized, especially one that kind of has some different facets to it. So that's kind of, and I started working on it with a friend from graduate school who actually had a master's degree in Black popular culture. In popular culture. And we would often have conversations about it actually being a field. So he ended up passing. And right when we were getting started, and so we had talked, when he was sick, we had talked about it. And one of our other graduate school buddies, Dwan, made really perfect sense for asking her to step in and work on it. And so that's kind of how it was born.
That's the genesis. So you didn't take up editing a journal in perpetuity.
No, I that wasn't really my idea. It was the editor at the press's idea. And I'm glad that my mentor said, why don't you just do another book like Black Popular Culture? Because it's been quite a long time since that came out. And she actually was the professor I took the class with in, I might as well say 1997. So people did warn me that edited volumes aren't exactly a cup of tea to do, but we, the contributors hung in there and, eventually we got it all pulled together.
I mean, it's a really, really interesting book. And that was also what I wanted to ask you about in terms of the construction of this edited volume, which does have a number of contributing chapters. But it also has a number of interviews that kind of preface each chapter. And I was curious about how you and Dwan came to sort of structure the book this way and include these chapters, particularly as you were kind of doing a kind of update of the 1992 work.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I would say it just sort of evolved organically, not that we set out thinking, okay, we'll have chapters, we'll have interviews. What really happened was there was one contributor who wasn't going to be able to get an essay in by the due date. And I thought, oh, darn it. I really wanted her to contribute. And so just really on a whim, I was like, well, would you do an interview? And she said yes. Hers ended up being the longest interview that was that's in it, and it really kind of ended up being an essay in and of itself. But and so then I thought, well, you don't want just one interview, and so we decided to kind of to get enough where they sort of were like bookends for each section, and to get people who have been who are more senior scholars and who have really situated what they are doing as Black popular culture studies and could talk about it in ways in which, we might better understand that it is a field of study that we are approaching and not, you liked Cardi B's latest rap video and you want to write a paper about it. But you don't have any sense of the Black cultural kind of genealogy in which she's producing that work. And you wouldn't see that happen in other forms of cultural studies, right? So that's how the interviews came. And then one other thing that I wanted to be sure that we had was visual and to some degree, or visual text. And so, the chapter, in the first section by E.K. Newsome was a very late addition to make it so that the visual art wasn't just stuck in. And we had to work with our editor, with Ken Wissaker, to kind of figure out how to bring in the visual without it just being stuck there standing by on its own. So the visual sort of essay was how we managed to do that.
And I think that it works really well because you're right. I mean, a lot of times when you are talking about popular culture in written form, you do have these static images, right? That they're taken from a film, but they're a static image. And so I totally understand the want and desire to integrate something that's more than just, as you say, stuck in image.
Yes.
in a book about popular culture. Because you also can't listen to the music while,
I know, right.
In the book, as it were, you can read the lyrics and so forth. But yeah, it is sort of the difficulty of writing about popular culture, but wanting to have the experience while you're doing it. And understanding it in its context. And so I did want to ask you a little bit about, sort of what you've nodded at also in terms of the history. You talked about the genealogy of understanding not only popular culture, but specifically Black popular culture. And you start out the book talking about the Stuart Hall essay and understanding essentially what is this Black? And this is a kind of frame for the dive that the book takes into so many different areas of understanding Black popular culture in our contemporary environment. Can you talk a little bit about how that framed a lot of the work that came into this book?
Of wanting to make sure that we recognize the sort of genealogy of Black popular culture.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Not just that, but also particularly the Stuart Hall question.
Oh. Well, I mean, the Stuart Hall question, it has been, and I mean, in some ways it's foregrounded, and it was foregrounded in the earlier collection. And it's been, you know, that particular essay has been reprinted so many times in so many different collections. But I also don't want to center it. And I know that one contributor pushes back against that. I think Patricia Hill Collins does. Yes. So, I mean, like thinking about what the Black is, that's an important thing. But I think that, for me, as I was really being introduced to Black popular culture as a field of study and not just, you know, something to pick up and do, I had to first begin to understand that folklore was part of Black popular culture, right? I mean, I think many times people just think of the very immediate now moments as Black popular culture, but I mean, it existed in eras, but it also comes out of these kind of folk traditions. And that's why earlier you would have these debates about low and high culture and things like that, that we've kind of moved past. Although I think you could see how they're still relevant in the sense of like curriculum and whether popular culture generally is incorporated into traditional disciplines or not, right? And some do and some don't. And I think it partly depends on what kind of departments they are, whether they choose to house popular culture studies within them. So like in the introduction, one thing that we talk about, and that was really great, I think, when I was interviewing Lisa Thompson, because she teaches them too, was going back to like the Harlem Renaissance, right? An era where you literally have African-American artists who are being, at least some of them, being supported by white benefactors who then want to influence, right, what Black art looks like and how you produce it. And you have these debates between people like George Schuyler and Langston Hughes and W.E.B. Du Bois about really kind of like what constitutes Black art. And you know, and so I think that's an important way of looking at, and even before you even begin to think about answering over time that question by Stuart Hall. And I think it helps you see how over time the answer, you know, changes or has more nuance and can be somewhat different in different contexts and time periods. So yes. So I think the question is important, but I think also kind of working through how we get to the point where we're at and is also important in how we approach working in the contemporary moment.
And I wanted to ask you, in terms of thinking about popular culture in general, as you said, there's kind of this tension as well within disciplinary areas, not only with regard to Black popular culture, but popular culture as a form of academic study. And you cite throughout the book does wrestle with this question of capitalism and the consumer economy that's connected to popular culture. And it's fairly forefronted in your book, which I think is important to understand the place where popular culture exists. But I was wondering if you could talk about how your own thinking about popular culture and specifically Black popular culture is situated within sort of this capitalism and consumer economy.
Okay, well, I think it's complicated. And I remember in Stuart Hall's essay there, he gets to the, not with that question that we all know, but a different part of the essay gets to the sort of vexed nature of being moving from the margins to the center, or from or for the popular to, or Black popular culture to be accepted or incorporated. And I think part of that is that you you lose some control over representation, right? So when it becomes mainstream, or when it becomes recognizable by the masses, then there's a part of it that doesn't belong to you anymore, right? That you can't control and exert the same kind of ownership over. And I think that, you know, when you aren't always controlling the production, that can have, you know, result in very precarious types of situations. And so the consumption does become very central. You know, whether it's, you know, whether it's Black artists who were pretty much like swindled out of good contracts, or where, you know, work wasn't copyrighted and then it was literally stolen and reproduced by white artists. You know, these types of situations, and I think some are more unique to particular time periods, but there's a way in which it continues, you know, still today. So I think that that is one. I think so. Capitalism and consumption are very much central to that, and the ways, you know, whether it's Black actors being paid less, Black visual art selling for less, there's always this way in which capital is at the center, right? And who's getting to profit. And a lot of times the producers themselves are not proper, are not profiting, or there's a real disparity in their profits. So that's, I think, it's something that haunts us, right? Because, I mean, even during, if you think about during the Harlem Renaissance, I mean, Zora Neale Hurston wrote about having to ask her benefactress, or as she called her fairy godmother, as about shoes, like buying a new pair of shoes, right? I mean, so contemporary cultural producers might not be quite in that same situation, but it's always a struggle. Right? There's always this struggle for equity.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's also more embedded in this dynamic, as you're saying, with regard to Black popular culture than popular culture in general.
Yes.
Because of the sort of undercutting and minimization of the credit or the person who's producing it, and how it operates in a capitalist setting or environment.
Yes.
And so I wanted to ask you to sort of take us through the book a bit. And it's divided into, as you note, sort of four sections and a final section, final interview. And they are all sort of umbrellas. And I loved the way that you and Duan sort of structured this, and not sort of saying, you know, films, music, you know, visual arts. And I thought that the sort of ideas of performing, politicizing, owning, and loving Blackness were really much more thoughtful and guiding in thinking about Black popular culture. So if you could take us through the sort of what these sections talk about, starting with performing Blackness, that would be fabulous.
Okay. So, yes, they are in what are more thematic or conceptual themes, and we kind of had to wait and see what we had as far as contributions to figure out what those might be. But we definitely didn't want. It's the other thing I think about popular culture is that it's kind of hard for it not to be interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
And to have, you know, these multiple disciplines that are really kind of simultaneously in conversation with one another. And so that, you know, we wanted to produce something that really kind of looks like how popular culture is produced. So Performing Blackness is the first, it's the first section. And so we cover television, music, and stage performance with the chapter. So Raylina Joseph's Mutts Like Me looks at specifically at comedy, but I think pretty much in the context of television shows, and really kind of interrogates this notion of the post-racial with some focus on Obama and so the ways in which actually it was his joke about being a mutt that frames her work. And then we have Black Radio with Emily Lordy, where which I think was really really interesting, the way in which she could bring in radio in the second decade of the 21st century, because there's a point where Black radio, you definitely would want it in a collection on Black popular culture, but not in, you know, 2015, 2020. It doesn't have that same, during the civil rights era, Black radio was critical. Before social media, you still had it as an important kind of Black community resource. But that's faded in some ways. But with these musical performers, she was able to kind of recenter that history and make it relevant for now, which I think is a great way of capturing how important it once was and how we have refashioned it in some ways to still make it useful. And then Vincent Stevens talks about cabaret music and camping, camp style, and resurrects some performers that I think many people would not be as familiar with, and thinks about that space of the cabaret and queer identities and performance that I think takes us to a place that many times people just don't think about when they think about Black popular culture. And also takes us back in time some to an earlier period, which I think is also important because Black popular culture existed prior to the immediate moment. And so it does a good job of helping us to remember that. And then the final actual essay is not the traditional essay. It's the visual essay by E.K. Newsome, who himself is an artist. And I owe a lot of gratitude to Nina Mercer, one of the other contributors, because I needed some artists to contribute. And I wanted it to be artists who are established as artists, but, you know, not necessarily the artists that are showing. I wanted it to be artists who, I don't know, who I could actually send an email to and say, would you contribute? as opposed to, you know, the ones who are in the Guggenheim or the Museum of Modern Art, or who we're very familiar with. And these artists do, I mean, they are familiar, but they just haven't, you know, had an entire exhibit at
the Guggenheim.
Right. But I think that still speaks to the way that art is produced, right? I mean, because even the ones who have had those exhibits at the Guggenheim started with, you know, with having to build up to that and having to really kind of engage in more kind of local communities first and then broader. So we have that, that essay, because I like we were talking about earlier, I wanted it to be as multi-sensory as possible, right? With the limits of print. So, and then for the interview, Lisa Thompson really made sense for this section as a playwright, and to think about performance. So section two.
The next one is politicizing Blackness.
Mm-hmm. And so that starts off with Kelly Jo Fulkerson DeCua's essay on the comic writer artist Jackie Orms. And again, and this one takes us back in time as well, shifts us from the very immediate contemporary moment. And you know, comics are increasingly becoming quite popular. I know at my university we actually have a comics like museum now, or comics library. And do a variety of annual like comics conferences. And I mean, and that runs through our English department, which is where popular culture is housed, popular culture studies is housed at the university. I mean, when I was doing degrees in English, nobody was talking about comics.
I know.
Right. I mean, and it's huge. I mean, Rebecca Wanzo just published a book on Black superheroes, and Deborah Whaley has done one as well on Black women in like comics or superheroes. So it's really changed a lot. But just because academics weren't really writing about comics 20 some years ago, doesn't mean that the comics didn't exist and that they weren't important political kinds of critiques. And I think it's great that it's an African-American woman that gets the focus in this text, because we often don't hear about them in that space.
It's a male, it tends to be a male dominated space.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about Jackie Orms before reading this essay. So, it was good to learn about that. I learned about her. And then we have Eric Darnell Preacher's, essay on queer kinships in, two like web series. I think since then there's been a number of, Black, like artists or directors who really were able to launch careers off of successful web series. I think we've kind of shifted from that platform, but when you have somebody like Issa Rae who started with Awkward Black Girl and then got her actual television series. And so, so I think the web series were an important kind of precursor for some of what we're seeing now with Black filmmakers and directors being able to get opportunities on platforms like Netflix and things like that. So Eric is looking at two web series and the ways in which queer kind of kinships and family are represented in those. I think that, you know, his offers that kind of important look at something that we're moving a little bit away from, but that is important for understanding where we're kind of at right now with television and film. And also important that he is having us look at like queer identities, which, you know, over time sometimes were often not addressed even when they clearly existed. And there's been work done on that too, but not quite enough. So, and then the last essay is David Leonard's on the NBA, right? And I know like sports, it's kind of, you know, oftentimes it's like in sociology and it's sort of like the sociology of sports. But there is that popular side of it as well. And so I thought it was really great how he looked at the sartorial politics of like fashion and the NBA, as opposed to the sort of athleticism or athletics side of it, which is really what you would often, which is what you're more likely to get, right? Or like the politicization of things like coaching, like Black coaches and, college players getting, whether they should be compensated for their images and things like that, that are not necessarily in the realm of popular culture. So, so he looks at fashion and the ways in which these players were using it to make political statements without necessarily saying anything. So,
and they continue to do that.
Yes. Various, I mean, you know, gestures, clothing, kneeling, right? I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. So, so it was good to have something about sports, in this one. And, the interview with Tracy Sharpley is more, international diasporic focused, partly that is the work that she does. But also in the Black Popular Culture collection from the 90s, it was actually much more, international than, US focused. And so, I did want to have some sense, right, of how culture flows and travels and, how we think about that.
Yeah, I found it really interesting I'm constantly thinking about that these days too, with regard to American culture flowing out, and how it's consumed elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And also what comes in and how we consume it. Or at least that was something I looked at in my first book. and so, yeah, so it goes both ways, and we don't necessarily always think about that.
And so the next section is Owning Blackness, where again we start having some of that discussion about the consumer and capitalist side of the product itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so Shanice Thompson is focused on Black Twitter, right, as a site of resistance, and focuses specifically on Baltimore and the murder of Freddie Gray by the Baltimore Police Department. And so, and looks at the ways in which Black Twitter responds and ways in which people resist through social media. And also brings in this sort of trope of signifying that that might present itself differently with sort of like each sort of generation or iteration of it. But that is, you know, it's a carryover from slaves being brought to the United States from Africa, from West Africa. And so it draws on West African folk traditions. So, you know, when you talk about signifying, you really are kind of historicizing, right, Black popular culture, and how it didn't just appear yesterday, right? It didn't just manifest out of whoever's the hottest thing last night. Right. And then Richard Schur does one that's on legal studies, or brings in legal studies, but by focusing on trademark and branding, and takes us back to like to fashion. And I think that this one is really interesting because I think if we think about the legal side of it, we might think a bit more about intellectual property, you know, when you're thinking about appropriation and things like that. And so to put the focus on trademarks and brands, I think is a really helpful way to think about like consumption as well as what people are, or profits, right?
Yeah.
Because I mean, we've branding has become quite big. I think even if people don't register it as branding, as what, you know, someone like P. Diddy or Sean Combs or whatever name he's going by now. I don't know what he's going by. Puff Daddy. I mean, but he wasn't just entertaining. Right? I mean, like, he's branding.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Beyonce
certainly is a brand.
Right. And I don't know that language always gets applied, and certainly not the kind of legal implications. Right. So I think that was kind of like a good interdisciplinary way of bringing that together and allowing us to think about like ownership. Black Culture Without Black People by Imani Kai Johnson looks at hip hop and appropriation. And I mean, that's been like a hot kind of debate that intersects some with the beginning of with the introduction. The first paragraph talks about Childish Gambino.
Yeah.
Donald Glover talking about that, yeah, you can hear about the Nene when it comes up, but that doesn't actually mean that you know much about Black popular culture, right? And, you know, and so with her thinking about the ways in which dance actually is appropriated, and just this desire to sort of like write Black people out of things that they produce, is, I think, an important discussion. And she also does multi-sided work. So I know she does New York City, but she has also done work. I know her work beyond her essay here, so I'm not remembering how much of it she addresses outside of the United States. But she does look globally as well at dance, Black dance culture, and particularly hip hop.
And
Nina Mercer's At the Corner of Chaos and Divine. And so I think Nina might have been the first person to submit her initial draft. So she was hanging in this for a long time because, you know, we know everybody doesn't make deadlines when things are due. But Nina did. She submitted it early and then you know, it took time to get this all together. And I loved that that it's so unconventional. Right. And that she's an artist. She's a practicing artist. She's a playwright. She is a performer. And so I think at first she wasn't sure if she should do something was just more traditional, you know, like the other essays. And I'm like, no, absolutely not. And if, you know, if the press doesn't like this, I will fight to keep it the way it is, because we have to, and that's another reason for bringing in the visual art. It's like we can't just be the academics, right, critiquing. Like,
culture,
we need people,
yeah,
to produce as well. And so I thought that was important, and the way in which she weaves it and puts it in conversation with like Black arts movement, with you know, actual kind of ritualistic Black ritual theater production, literally like in the streets, was important. And then with this one, we have Mark Anthony Neal, who was really one of the early people, early scholars, really identifying as doing Black popular culture and with really kind of propelling it forward as a field of study with his early work focused on that. You know, he did a lot with music, but he broadly did Black popular culture. So we have him closing out that section.
And then the final section, which also features your beautiful essay on Moonlight, is on loving Blackness.
Yes. I guess that one maybe took a little finessing trying to figure out how to pull it together and what you call it. But we have we have Takiya Amin with The Booty Don't Lie, which I love the title, and talking about dance, but also Black bodies, right, and Black flesh and agency within these performances, but also with like appropriation, right, and bodies, and you know, what does it mean when like Miley Cyrus is twerking and in relationship to particularly to Black women's bodies in that context. But she goes through a variety of different types of dances, like the Harlem Shake and Jay Setters and different things, and walks us through that history, which for me, I always think history is history matters to me so much. I'm not a historian, but we're not trained as a historian, but it's important to see these genealogies and evolutions. And so her chapter walks us through some of that as well. So my chapter is on Moonlight, and I waited until really kind of the end to decide what I, because there's so many different things that I could write on, to kind of see what was missing, or what did I hope maybe we had would have had and didn't. And I realized we didn't have any film. And it just, I mean, it that's just sort of how it ended up with who the final contributors were. But I'm like, there's no way that we cannot have film. And that really is my probably favorite area to work in. So Yeah, first I started out with, and I ended up publishing it elsewhere, but I started out with a film on, or with a writing about Black romance films, and then decided to switch to Moonlight after it came out. And so I talk about space, I talk about sound.
And silence.
And focus on like the soundtrack and the ways in which we kind of read this like Black boys' queer identity formation in this particular space and time, and through the sound, through the music, and through the silence, particularly the silence and dialogues, and where the music fills in for the lack of dialogue. And we get some screenshots too from the film there. So it's like, oh yeah, you don't have to get permission or pay for these. So, I mean, it's, you know, I do visual studies. I actually, in the visual essay, one of the pieces of art is mine. So yeah, I always want to see something. And then the last essay in that chapter is Kinoki Nishikawa. And I think his, actually, we get to see a little bit with that one too, because he one of the covers from one of the, novels that he talks about. So he looks at urban fiction, and Black women readers, and, you know, this kind of the urban fiction boom was, it was really quite a boom of the 90s, and into the 2000s. But, you know, whether it was on Oprah Winfrey or whether it was just like, particularly with Black women, talking to each other about it. So Terry, you know, whether for me early on, it was hearing about Terry McMillan in the 90s and people like Elin Harris. And so he, looks at that industry and focuses on Black women in that context, which
and they buy books.
Yeah, buy books, read books.
Exactly. Have conversations about books. I mean, it's sort mm-hmm. of funny every time you sort of see somebody surprised by like, oh, women are people who buy and read books, and. You know, and then there are these subgenres inside of books.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and I think it, you know, it's that particular industry, both like the urban fiction and around that same time, a lot of self-help, right? Kind of like Black focused self-help books came out. And so then you did end up having some scholars who addressed like Black women as readers, Black women's book clubs, and the book clubs are still quite popular, even virtually. Like my sorority has my historically Black sorority has a virtual book club during COVID. So yes, it's a side of to go back to Donald Glover, sort of this part of Black culture that society doesn't really know. Right? Like they might think they know Black people, but they don't really know that well.
And then you and so the whole book with Lisa Thompson.
Yep. The final interview is Patricia Hill Collins. And that's the one that I think is the equivalent of an essay. And it just seemed fitting to end with her, even though it seemed fitting to end with her, even though you know, she's trained as a sociologist, and sometimes you find Black popular culture within sociology departments. But I think that her work has always made us look out, right, outside of the academy, looking at the realm of popular culture. And in some of her work, she does explicitly address popular culture. So it just seemed like a fitting way to end. And also she does some sharp critiques too, right? It's not all love for it. There's some ways in which she questions certain things. And I think that those are good and important conversations that need to be had.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was confusing two of the interviews. I apologize for that.
Oh, no, that's fine.
And I was reading the Patricia Hill Collins just before we came on, and finding it really fascinating the way she was, again, sort of conceptualizing and thinking about the questions that you start the book with. So it's a beautiful way to sort of end the book too, because it does thread through a lot of what you start out with and that you've also sort of mentioned, the role of context and the genealogy and understanding the evolution of Black popular culture, both in the United States and elsewhere. And I found it a very good conclusion.
good.
And
we wanted it to work that way.
and as you said, it while it was an interview, it was a kind of more like a meditation, and an essay, which also, again, it's like the book was really interesting to read because it did have so many parts that you read and experienced in different ways, like popular culture, which I really appreciated because, as you say, it's a print book and there's only so much you can do.
Right.
But I found that going through the book was really an experience that's different from a lot of just reading a book. So kudos to you.
Well, that's good.
And your co-author. And I wanted to ask you now, what are you working on to follow this up?
Well, one thing I just want to interject is that it's unfortunate Dwan couldn't participate. She teaches high school American studies and English, so she doesn't have quite the same flexibility in her schedule like I do. But she is a phenomenal editor. I have used her for two of my books as well, just to not for the technical, well, she's good with the technical, but also with the ideas and really pushing people to flesh out their ideas and to think in all these different kinds of ways that I'm glad that came through in the final product. So, I just want to shout out to her. And so with what I'm working on now, I think I'm about ready for Dwan to give me some feedback on my current project, because it always pushes me to be better. But I'm working on a project that has been in the making and in the works for a while. It's called Becoming Educated, A Midwest Story of Race and Law and Culture. And I started it. I decided to go to law school when I was on tenure track. I won't even get into how that happened. It was, I'm still sometimes not sure how it really happened, but the pragmatist that I am, I'm like, okay, I cannot do these finals and have nothing that comes out of it. So the classes that, weren't exam based, I would make sure that my essays kind of fit either my last monograph on Black masculinities, When We Imagine Grace. So a number of those chapters were written there. But then there were this project, I wrote a couple, and it just sort of came out of a jurisprudence class and having to pick something to basically determine if it was just. So I went with, is education under the law just, or something like that? And I had to figure out what to write it on. So at the time, two of my three sons were in a small private school called Mansion Day School, which was not always all Black, but with some sort of demographic shifts in Columbus, Ohio, ended up becoming with a lot of the white and Asian students eventually moving to suburban school districts. The school kind of fascinated me because it was run kind of like a mini HBCU, but also very much on the model of Southern education between Reconstruction and desegregation. And so I wanted to think about the ways that Black middle-class parents, when they have at least some means, what kind of choices are available to them? And so then it just sat. I had two chapters. I got some grants to do some some to go to like Mississippi and visit this boarding school, this Black boarding school, Piney Woods. And it just sat, and I got busy. I went into administration. I needed to finish Are You Entertained? And I kept resisting going back to it. And I think I decided that I didn't really like the way it was going. people liked it, but it was kind of like a mix between a historical study and law review journal article. And like, that's not totally me. And so now the way that I'm doing it, and I had a fellowship this summer with the center, at the National Gallery for the Center for Advanced, for the Study in Advanced Visual Art or something. I can't remember. It's CASPA.
Okay.
I mess up the prepositions where the prepositions belong in that name. But I decided to bring in, I decided to instead tell a story about desegregation of Columbus public schools and to do it through art, visual art and music, and narrative of some of the kind of legal and historical things that happened. And I tell it from the perspective of actually being from Columbus, Ohio, and being and starting kindergarten 1 year after the Supreme Court ordered schools to be desegregated, which was very late compared to most of the rest of the country. And so I kind of tell the stories that led up to that. I tell my stories of going through an integrated school system, and then of being a parent. Right, who's upper middle class instead of working class as I grew up, and trying to make choices and the different choices that my children have experienced, which really are quite across the spectrum. So they're like kind of little vignettes that tell these different little stories, and I bring in visual art because for me, like becoming educated wasn't just about what was happening in the classroom. And it's kind of like my sense of popular culture too, and my sense of the law. It's like, the law is informed by, I don't care what it says about colorblind justice and all that. It's informed by culture, and culture also is informed by the law. So, what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing, or what I can see now when I think about what I experienced is just as much about becoming educated in these particular spaces as the legal cases that dictated to some extent how I was educated. And how children now are being educated when the courts have determined that we've met the threshold for desegregation and they no longer enforce it. Right. So that's what I'm working on now. And
so it's multimedia.
I'm having fun doing it, which maybe is the most important thing, because it's like, and I moved that way with my second book. I can't remember what really old English word my editor at Chicago used for it, but it's basically like it was really eclectic. And this one is even more so, but I mean, the other thing that I wanted was, some of the like public speaking I've done, especially on visual and popular culture, I've had family members who have shown up at the events and I don't tell them to come. They see it on Facebook. And so they've shown up. And actually I have really enjoyed the conversations that I have with them. And these are people who are by far not academics. I've really enjoyed the conversations I've had with them, and they've really enjoyed what I've talked about in ways that I don't think my students often enjoy what I have to talk about. And so I have been working more and more towards trying to make my, the scholarship that I'm doing, basically be engaged, that it's more public facing, that it's more engaged. And unlike my first book where, I had lots of family and friends who, even like my husband's friends, they're really excited that I published a book. They don't know anybody who's published books. And then when I tell them the title, they're like, oh, what does that mean? Like, we didn't even get into what the book is about, but it's like, well, what's the title mean? And so I was like, okay, I need to rethink like my audience. And I don't think my audience is entirely an academic audience that I really want to be able to have conversations with. And so I think this book will do that. I hope that maybe we can, at the Wexner Center here at Ohio State, Wexner Center for the Arts, maybe exhibit some of the visual art that I analyze.
Cool.
I also wrote a children's story that's an to accompany the book. This all just sort of like organically happened. It's like one day I just woke up and I was like, oh,
that's what I'm
doing. I want to write this book called The Good Morning Space or The Good Morning Spot. And it connects because it's kind of like about how my youngest child sort of become educated on like mommy needing space, right? And how he fits into that space. And I haven't illustrated it yet, but I'm going to give it a shot. That's wow. Usually not, it's not usually the kind of medium that I use when I do art, but I figure, well, I'll try it. If not, I have a friend that I'll ask if he wants to illustrate it. So I'm like, I'm hoping that the book and the children's book can kind of be paired and that we might have an exhibit and I don't know, who knows?
That sounds so cool. Well, I hope that I will be able to talk to you about the published book and possibly also the children's book on the podcast again.
Oh, that'd be great. I finished this book up. I started in 2013 in law school classes, but I should have it fully drafted with it. Well, COVID messed up some things.
COVID messed up everything. I hear you.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to thank you for being with me today, Simone Drake, one of the two editors with Dwan Henderson of Are You Entertained? Black Popular Culture in the 21st Century. This is published by Duke University Press in 2020, and it's available on the Duke University Press website, I assume, and any place else one likes to buy their books. Thank you so much for joining me today, Simone.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Lily. I very much enjoyed talking to you, and I hope to talk to you again.